Well, picking up from where we left off last time, now we're going to move into what we call the apostolic period, the first generation after Jesus. From the death of Jesus until the fall of Jerusalem, about 34 years, Jesus' followers were very few during this period and also persecuted, so it was a very crucial period for their survival. If they didn't make it out of this period, they're not going to make it. Before we begin, though, I have to make a point about terminology. Jesus' first followers did not call themselves Christians. The word Christian actually appears in the Bible only three times, twice in the book of Acts, and then once in a letter of Peter. But it doesn't say that they're all calling themselves Christians here. Okay, one of them, in Acts, it says that, and this is from, like, talking about the 50s, maybe, yeah, about the 50s or so. It says that Antioch, which is north of the region where Jesus was from, that's where they first started using the word Christian. But it doesn't say that everyone was using it by that time. That's when the word first started being used. Okay, the word Christian, by the way, contains a suffix that commonly signifies the followers or partisans of a particular leader. So Christian means, in the original Greek, a follower or partisan of Christ. Because of its political connotation, we generally think the term was coined by Roman officials in Greek cities who used it in a derogatory way. By the way, this is common. We're going to see this all over the place where, even among Christians, where you want to kind of put down somebody else, you call them followers of some guy because he's a recent guy and, you know, he's not anyone that important. So they say Christian, they're basically saying, oh, those followers of that guy, Christus or whatever. And then later on, Christians will do the same, like when some people have different beliefs or whatever, they're like, oh, you're just a follower of so-and-so. And then sometimes these groups actually accept the name after a while, even though originally it's derogatory, then finally, well, we kind of like that. Okay, so that probably happened here with Christian, too. So most of the original disciples probably never even heard that word before. So the question is, what did they call themselves? Well, there's no consistent name that everyone uses. Sometimes the religion is called the Way. We see that in the book of Acts. Because, you know, it's a way of life, or it's the way that Jesus taught us, or whatever. That's where they get that from. A lot of times you'll hear the word, the expression, the disciples. Sometimes it'll be fully the disciples of the Lord, but then for short, just the disciples. Okay? Which means, you know, students, followers. Okay? Sometimes you'll see them referred to as the brothers, talking about their familial relationship with one another. Talk about the brothers. And they refer to women in this group too. They don't usually say brothers and sisters. They just say the brothers. This is ancient times after all, not very PC. Sometimes they refer to themselves as the saints. And the word saints, this means a holy one, the holy ones. Okay? Similar to kind of what the Essenes were calling themselves. And then sometimes you will see the term the Nazareans, which probably means the people who followed the guy from Nazareth. Okay? Although some people have tried to associate it with the term Nazarite, which is in the Old Testament, referring to special holy people, but I don't really think it's connected with that at all. Okay. Now, despite all that, and do we pick one of those? When we refer to this group, which one do we want to use? Well, scholars have decided on a completely new term that wasn't used at all back then, but because they didn't really have a single term, they just have made up a term, and that's the Jesus movement. Which is not very romantic or anything. But for the first generation after Jesus, scholars and historians generally use the term the Jesus movement. Okay? So that's what I will do, although I'm sure I will slip up and say Christian from time to time. Okay? I will start using the word Christian consistently after the first generation, after 70 or so, we can start calling them Christians. Okay? The earliest oral traditions. Since the letters of Paul are the first written documents we have from Christians, they're the best source we've got for the earliest beliefs and practices in this first generation, because Paul lived right in this generation. All right? Now, his letters often contain traditions that are earlier than him. He's writing mostly in the 50s, okay? But he has things in there that are from earlier. So often you will see him use expressions like, I received and handed on to you this bit of information. And then he tells them. That tells you that he heard it from somewhere and now he's passing it along. This is how the message got spread, right? I received this and I'm handing it on to you. And a lot of these traditions are memorized. Or there might even be like excerpts from Christian hymns, okay, where they memorize sayings. And he'll have these early traditions. Actually, yes, here's a couple examples right here. These are both from letters of Paul. Actually, this is definitely from a letter of Paul. This may or may not be from a letter of Paul, but fairly early. These are believed to have been preformed traditions, probably excerpts from hymns. And they're so similar to each other, you wonder if they're actually part of the same hymn, okay, that are being quoted in the letters. That'll give us a little indication as to what kind of beliefs these people had. So, give thanks to Christ, who, though existing in God's form, gave no thought to his Caesar that he should be equal with God, but he humbled himself, having taken a slave's form, having become in the likeness of men, and having been found fashioned as a man. He made himself lowly, he having become obedient unto death, yes, death on a cross. Well, I don't have to read the whole thing to you, do I? Anyway, and then God exalted him after he died, so that in the name of Jesus every knee should bend, okay? And you acknowledge Jesus as Lord to the glory of God the Father, okay? And this is kind of very similar here, too. He's the image of God, the firstborn of all creation, okay? It's not clear from the second part whether... See, we're trying to figure out like what some of the early beliefs about Jesus were. Now, if we're just going to think logically without even looking at this for a second, we would say, well, it would be very Jewish at the beginning, and then it would gradually get less Jewish as time went on, right? And what's the Jewish idea about the Messiah? They didn't believe the Messiah was God, okay? They believed the Messiah was the Son of God in the sense that he would be like the heir to the throne, like the King David was or whatever like that. When is it that the Christians started believing that, first of all, Jesus had an existence before he was born? Like that, there was an idea that would develop that Jesus existed before he was born, and then he came to the earth and lived his life, and then he died, and then he went back to heaven. Right? It's a little unclear here. Now, in the second one, firstborn of all creation. Now, you could take that to mean like when God created the heavens and the earth, he made Jesus first. Or does firstborn simply refer to his position in creation? Right? And then when it says, in him everything was established in the heavens and on the earth, does it mean that Jesus was partly the creator of the earth? You wonder, but then it starts saying that he established governments and authorities and thrones and lordships. Well, when did that happen? That didn't happen in Genesis. So you wonder. So a lot of it's unclear. When you're talking about poetry here, things are unclear. Okay, but you do see a number of things about his position in the church. He's the head of the church, right? He's the firstborn from the dead. And so he holds the first place, at least in that respect. And then there's a word I want to introduce you here to called pleroma. And it seems to refer to everything that encompasses divinity. Anything that is divine, that is part of God or something like that. So... God saw good for all of the essence of divinity, right, to dwell in him, that is in Jesus. Okay? Now, is that something that God gave to him after he died? Unclear. All right, or did he always have that or whatever? But we look at these earliest oral traditions that Paul is quoting from to learn a little bit about some of the early beliefs. Okay? What we generally believe, though, is that Christian Christology, the teaching about Christ and what his position was, gradually developed from a Jewish understanding into a higher Christology where Jesus was far more important in the universal scheme of things than the Jews originally thought. Okay, Aramaic sayings. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is shown as using the Aramaic language quite a bit. Here's an example, like in Mark 5. Oh, where am I going here? Mark 5. He says, this is in verse 41. He then took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kum. That's an Aramaic saying. And then Mark says, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, get up. And then she got up and walked. Mark does that a lot. Jesus will come up and he'll talk to somebody and he'll say, and then he'll say something in Aramaic. And so we believe that this actually represents what Jesus actually said. Okay? That he's speaking in Aramaic and Mark is just making sure to translate it into Greek. But sometimes he actually will give you the Aramaic words. Paul himself uses the term Abba a few times, which means Father, and as in prayer. Say Abba. And we believe that, you know, like for example, when Jesus gave the Lord's Prayer, that he actually would have used the term Abba at the beginning in Aramaic. And Paul also uses another expression, Maranatha, which means come, Lord. So there are hints that Jesus spoke Aramaic. There's also hints of an early tension in the church, in the very first generation here, between those who followed Jesus who spoke Aramaic and those who followed Jesus who spoke Greek as their primary language. So, for example, we have in the book of Acts, chapter 6, right at the very beginning, a reference to this. In those days, as the number of the disciples was multiplying, there arose a complaint by the Hellenistic Jews against the Hebraic Jews that their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution. Okay? The Hellenistic Jews, meaning the Greek-speaking urban Jews, and the Hebraic Jews, meaning the Aramaic-speaking country Jews. And that the latter were the ones who were being favored, because that's who the apostles were. That's the 12 were from that group. They're from these country Jews, spoke Aramaic. In the early days, they tended to be favored over the new converts, who tended to be people from the city, the Hellenistic Jews. And so there was a tension between the two groups in the early church. All right? But I want to talk a little bit about the organization of the early church. And I want to introduce you to this Greek word, ecclesia. Sometimes you'll see it spelled with two K's instead of two C's. Whatever the case, it is a... Actually, I have up there the Latinized form of the Greek word. If you're going to transliterate it directly from Greek, it'll be two K's. But that doesn't matter. Okay, what matters is that is the word that we normally translate church. Okay, it literally means, though, not a building, but a community of people. All right, an assembly, a congregation, community. It is used two ways in early Christian literature. It can refer to a local group, okay, just one small local group, all right, or it can refer to the entire body of Jesus' followers throughout the whole world. So when I talk about like the name of this class, the early Christian church, that word, church, I'm using to refer to all of the followers of Jesus everywhere. Okay? But many times, and in fact, most frequently in the early literature, it will be referring to an individual local group. Okay? Because you have little groups and you have big groups. Okay? And the word is used either way. There were no church buildings in this period. We won't have distinctively Christian architecture developing for a couple hundred years. Most of the Christian and, I should say, Jewish meeting places from these early centuries that have been discovered, and I'm not even talking about this period, I'm talking about like the next century, even then, they look like houses that have been converted into churches or synagogues. You know what I'm saying? What, in fact, is the case here is that in this time period, congregations or ecclesias, all right, were centered in houses. They met in the homes of individual believers. And for that reason, we tend to call them house churches, because they're churches meeting in a house. Okay? And it just means whoever happens to volunteer and say, hey, we can have the meeting at my house. All right? And that's where they'd have it. A number of references in the early literature confirms that basic social organization. So, for example, when we read letters of Paul, okay, he's our earliest source, he will address his letters to or from so-and-so, and the church in his or her house. The book of Acts supports that picture. I'm going to read you a little something from chapter 2, all right, which you should have read by now. But anyway, this is chapter 2. Just so you know, when you're reading these texts, the big numbers are the chapters and the little numbers are the verses. And so when I give citations, that's what I was talking about. Anyway, here's what it says in Acts chapter 2. This is beginning in verse 42, I guess you could say. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayers. Then fear came over everyone, and many wonders and signs were being performed through the apostles. Now all the believers were together and had everything in common. This is talking about how they shared everything. So they sold their possessions and property and distributed the proceeds to all as anyone had a need. And then here's the point. And every day they devoted themselves to meeting together in the temple complex and broke bread from house to house or in their homes, in each individual's house. They ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people, blah, 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 blah. All right, so anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is that there were assemblages of the followers of Jesus in the temple, all right, because they were all Jewish in these early days, simply with the added belief in Jesus, okay? But they'd still go to temple, they'd do something there, but then afterward, they'd go over to whoever's house, one of their own members, and then they would do additional Jesus stuff in addition to what they were doing at the temple, which you can't really do the Jesus stuff there, okay? So they'd go to each other's houses, okay? During the course of Paul's dealings with various groups that he either started or met with, we see him referring to a number of at least six different distinct house churches he refers to. It's clear that, like for example, when he's writing to the Corinthians, and I didn't have you read that letter, but the worship is taking place in people's homes, typically in the dining room, we believe, where they also celebrated the Eucharist, and I'll tell you about the Eucharist in a minute. But here are some basic facts about the makeup of the ecclesias as they are described in Paul's letters. First of all, these communities tended to cluster around established households, and there would be like a not only the nuclear family that would live in a household, by the way. In those days, you often had an extended family living there. So, you know, these are houses with sometimes grandma and grandpa are there, and maybe even Uncle Joe, you know, whatever. They're all living in a house together. And there might even be slaves there or other clients or business associates that happen to be staying there. But then, of course, they would invite other followers of Jesus over for special meetings. Okay, so they're probably people who are a little bit more well-off because they have a bigger house. And both men and women are known to have headed these house churches because Paul mentions both men and women whose houses they're at. Okay, the owner of the house where the church met was considered its host or patron. And he or she actually also exercised considerable authority over the group. Paul and his traveling co-workers, I guess you could say, usually stayed with the house church patron because they didn't have, you know, they're traveling around. They don't have a place to stay. Usually they go to wherever the church is meeting, someone's house, and they'd stay at that person's house. And from what we can tell from Paul's letters, he typically was the one who would baptize the house church patron. Okay, and then the house church patron would go on then to baptize other people. When Paul wrote letters to various ecclesias, from what we can tell, the letter was given to the house church patron, and then the house church patron would either read it if they could read, or they'd have somebody read it to the rest of the church. All right. Important features of kind of the solidarity of these individual groups was hospitality, course, and communal fellowship. There's a social aspect to all of this. It isn't just you go there, you listen to some guy talk, and then you leave. There's definitely kind of this is a social group. They did a lot of things together besides just worship. And even at the worship meetings, they would do fellowship activities. We'll talk about them in a second. All right, so now we're going to talk about some customary Christian activities, or not Christians yet, but activities that the church engaged in. The followers of Jesus in the New Testament period continued to participate in traditional Jewish observances, as far as we can tell, because they were from a Jewish background. But they were increasingly being forced out of Jewish synagogues. It depends on kind of how, in one particular region or whatever, how the local Jews felt about them. Because they would go and they would engage in all the activities like they always had been. But then, you know, they start talking about this Jesus, and the other people there would get a little irritated. And sometimes, if they were mad enough about it, they would say, "We don't want you here anymore." So then they were forced to meet on their own. But we have evidence for followers of Jesus meeting in synagogues for quite a number of decades past this period. Okay, just depends on the region. So the customary worship activities in the synagogues were often carried over into the house church meetings. At the synagogues, there would be scripture reading, prayers, teaching. You'd sing hymns or psalms, okay? There'd be exhortations like, okay, we need to do this or just to do that. We need to be better people. Well, those things were carried over into the house church meetings because that was traditional, okay? But I want to talk about some specifically unique Christian activities or activities of the Jesus movement, all right? And the first and most important would be the Eucharist. Paul provides us with the earliest reference to the Eucharist ritual, all right, in his first letter to the Corinthians. And he says, he relates this tradition that Jesus had one last meal with the 12 apostles, and he broke bread and poured the wine, and they did a little ritual with the bread and the wine. Okay, and they all ate a little bread, drank a little wine, but he likens the bread to his own body, and he likens the wine to his own blood. And by drinking it and eating it, somehow they are expressing solidarity with Jesus. Now, different church groups will have maybe slightly different interpretations of exactly what it means, but it was a communal activity, and it was a way of saying, okay, we belong to each other, and we also belong to Jesus, and this was a major ritual that they engaged in. The word Eucharist comes from a Greek verb meaning to give thanks. Okay, so it's thanksgiving. The Eucharist is a form of thanksgiving, so that certainly was associated with the ritual. Okay, they're thankful, perhaps, for Jesus shed blood, or that he gave up his body, you know, for the cause or whatever, and that could be why it has to do with giving thanks, or that God sent Jesus to them, and that they're giving thanks for that. All right. The owners of the houses probably supplied the food for these activities. Today, this same ritual is continued to be performed, although sometimes under different names, the Lord's Supper or Communion or Mass or something like that. So it just depends on the church. But it all goes back to the same particular celebration, the Eucharist. By the way, I should also mention that in that world, at that time, whatever groups there were in the Greco-Roman world, there was often these fellowships for different reasons. They would often have a ritual that kind of expressed their solidarity with one another, and it was a way of saying, okay, this is our group. You know, so it fits right into the cultural context. You know what I'm saying? All right. The agape meal, the agape feast. It was a very loosely structured early service that typically included a social meal. Food was eaten at it. And we believe that it was very widely it was practiced that while you were having the agape feast, which is a fellowship meal, like you'd have dinner at the house church, you know, in the dining room, and then you'd have the Eucharist while you were eating, which is kind of what Jesus is depicted as doing in the account of the Last Supper. So in the early days, we believe that they probably had an agape feast, and then they did the Eucharist along with it. But then later, the two got separated. And pretty soon, the agape feast will just die out altogether. Once they start not having house churches anymore, and you just go to a building, you don't really have a potluck anymore. But you would when you go to a person's house. That's a little different. But the agape feast was a very important ritual in the early days. Okay, agape is a Greek word meaning love. There's all different kinds of Greek words for love, and this particular word refers to a kind of like a principled love. Okay, the kind you would have, you love somebody in principle. You know, kind of a higher form of love. It's not romantic love or something like that. Okay. Then we have baptisms, which would be a form of initiation into the community. Remember when John was doing it, that it was in symbol of, expression of repentance. Okay, and we think that some early Jesus followers continued to use that kind of symbolism. Others, however, seem to have other ideas. Some kind of a cleansing ritual, it's cleaning you, or just a rite of initiation, a dedication. There does not seem to have been a single interpretation across the board. Okay, but everybody did it. It was very widely practiced. I think every community that we know of did engage in this particular ritual. Okay, so it became like the universal mark of, you know, you are now one of us when you get baptized. We don't actually have any full physical descriptions of how it's done in this first generation. We can assume maybe they did it like John the Baptist, but there probably were different regional practices. They might have done it differently. So we can't really say for certain because we don't have any real good descriptions of it. Those are the three main rituals that we know this first generation practiced: the Eucharist, the Agape Feast, and baptism. There will be new ones that come up, but during this early period, these are the three biggies. Okay? Oh, by the way, these are very early paintings and sculptures of Christians at a either at an Agape Feast or celebrating the Eucharist. Okay? Some of them are just look like a social meal or whatever. But you notice how they're designed? Doesn't it kind of remind you of the picture of the Last Supper? Okay? It's because it's kind of based on that. Or one's based on the other. But they would sit around and they would have these fellowship meals. And these are early representations. They're not from this period. They're from maybe 100 years later. But they're our earliest representations of this. Okay? All right, community welfare. You know, even in the Jewish community, there was a provision for helping out the poor and the needy and so on and so forth, right? The widows and the orphans. And so this carried over into a pattern in the church, okay? We actually have references in Acts, for example, of trying to help out those in need. I also read you about how in the distribution of these provisions, some people felt like they were being left out. I said there were Hellenistic Jews. Now, when I say they're Jews, I mean they're Jews who have accepted Jesus. Okay, so they're Hellenistic ones, and then there were the Aramaic-speaking rural ones, and there was a complaint about, you know, the urban Hellenistic ones were not getting as much stuff, and they were. So that's in Acts chapter 6. Anyway, so there is evidence in this early period of, you know, taking care of those in your group who are in need. All right, by giving and then spreading it around. Okay, so it's kind of a socialistic sort of community. All right. All right. Now, how was the message spread in these early days? I kind of intimated about this before, but there was no Christian literature yet. Okay. I mean, there are letters. We have letters of Paul. I did say that. I don't know if you really call that literature. It's more like somebody's mail, okay? But we have that. But most people, okay, were not literate. So you're going to have your group, okay, everybody, we have to spread the message about Jesus, okay? You're not going to give them a bunch of pamphlets or tracts to distribute because most of the people they talk to wouldn't be able to read it, okay? So how do you spread the message? You talk, you tell them about it. All right? So the way that the message was spread was orally. And literature played a very secondary role in the spread and development of Christianity during this early period. The personal witness of individuals who had known Jesus was the most authoritative. And that's why the apostles themselves are such a big deal, because, hey, we knew Jesus, okay? And he told us all this stuff, and now we're telling you. All right. But other people spread the message as well. People who heard the apostles, or people who heard the apostles, and so on and so forth. But it was all done in an oral way. That was the good news, the gospel. The word gospel, evangelion in Greek, evangelion, means good news. All right, the gospel, and it was spread orally. And I have here some of the early missionary journeys according to the book of Acts. Okay, so if we can rely on this book, then these are some of the tracks that some of the apostles took and other preachers in spreading it. So we're just kind of in the land around where Jesus was from, Judea, Samaria. Okay, they seem to have concentrated on Judea first, then into Samaria, and then they continued moving on after that. But so this is where it's. Who would they be talking to? Jews, and then secondarily to Samaritans, who are very closely related to Jews. Okay, before moving out into the rest of the world. Leaders of the churches. It's very easy to fall into the trap of making unhistorical assumptions about what the New Testament text says about leaders and about offices. Okay? Because many of the words that are used in the New Testament continue to be used throughout the centuries. Right? So when I refer to something like a bishop, okay? All these things come to mind about what a bishop is. It's the guy on the chessboard, you know, with the pointy hat or whatever. But all these are later things that develop and are associated with these titles. And as historians, when we're looking at the early text and it mentions people like that, we have to be careful to kind of strip away all the baggage and start all over. Blank slate. Let's look at the evidence. What was a bishop like then? Okay? Or whatever other position we're talking about, instead of imposing all these later ideas onto it. Okay? So that's one thing to be careful about. Anyway, let's talk about some of the leaders. Now, I mentioned the apostles a couple of times. The New Testament makes it pretty clear that the apostles were the highest ranking, I guess you could say, officials. Are they officials? But anyway, they seem to be definitely leaders of some kind in the early church. There were 12 to begin with that are said to have been appointed by Jesus himself. Then there were, one of them was a traitor, and in the very beginning of Acts, the traitor was replaced with another guy. Okay, his name is Matthias, but you don't have to remember that. We don't have any other examples of the 12, you know, when they die, that no one seems to replace them at all, but the word apostle means ambassador. So when we think about an apostle being an ambassador, we're saying, oh, well, who are they an ambassador for? They're an ambassador for Jesus. Okay, we're here to represent Jesus. We're here on his behalf, to speak on his behalf. But in particular, the job of the apostles, at least the way the book of Acts represents them, says that their job, okay, was twofold. And you might say this doesn't tell you much. It was one, apostleship, okay, and two, service. Ambassadorship, I guess you could say, and service. Now, when talking about service, that simply means taking care of members of the church. In other words, the needy, those in need. So part of their job was to help out the ones that needed help in a physical, material way, making sure that the food gets distributed to them and so on. There's a lot of that going on in the early chapters of Acts. Okay, and then the ambassadorship would suggest they're entering into foreign territory as missionaries to present a message on behalf of someone else, and that would be Jesus. Okay? That message is the gospel, the good news. So they are the chief missionaries of the movement. So their two jobs are to be missionaries and to provide for the needy in the church. That was their main two tasks. As missionaries, then, they would not stay in one place. They didn't stay in Jerusalem, but they did return there from time to time, from what we can tell. They traveled very widely, but probably stayed in the regions of Judea, Samaria, and Galilee, and maybe got up into Syria on occasion. We don't think that they got much further than that. Now, others, later on, like Paul, claimed. Paul was not one of the 12, by the way. A lot of people get this confused. He was not one of the 12. Later, he claimed that he too was an apostle. Now, he went a lot farther. He went into Asia Minor, Greece, and into Italy. He's like the 13th apostle or something like that. But most of the others did not do that. We also have a reference to another apostle. This is kind of interesting. And it's in one of Paul's letters in Romans, which you didn't have to read. And he mentions, this is in chapter 16, verse 7, a certain Junia, who was an apostle, J-U-N-I-A. He says she is of note among the apostles. It's a woman. That's interesting. A woman apostle? Come on. But it did cause some consternation later because in some early manuscripts, people added an S on the end of her name, changing Junia to Junius, which makes it a man's name. Suggesting that, oh, well, we can't obviously leave this as written. We're going to have to change it into a man's name. Now, you could make the argument, well, maybe Junius is the correct reading and someone just accidentally left off the S. Suppose that's possible. But seems like the more likely reason for a change is because it would have gone against kind of what they would want. And having a woman in charge or something like that maybe wouldn't have not set right with some people later on. And that's why they changed it. You can't understand why they would change it from a woman, from a man to a woman, unless it was just a mistake. Okay, but there are several manuscripts that say Junia. All right. Anyway, so there may have been women apostles. Okay, and it also seems from the very fact that Paul never met Jesus, at least while Jesus was still alive, and we don't know of any Junia being of the original 12. That other people could be apostles besides the 12. But we don't have evidence of that many. Maybe it's just a name for an important missionary, you know? So it's difficult to tell. Okay. Now, what about some other leaders? We get evidence from this in the earliest sources, and that's Paul. Okay? Let me read you a little passage from Paul. This is in a letter that you didn't have to read, but it's from his first letter to the Corinthians. And he has an interesting passage here in chapter 12, verse 28. He says, "And God has placed these in the churches. First, apostles. Second, prophets. Third, teachers. Next, miracles, then gifts of healing, helping managing various kinds of languages, and so on." But when he says, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, it sounds like he's enumerating who has the most authority, who has the next most authority, and who has the next most authority. Right? Apostles, number one. Prophets, number two. Teachers, number three. And then if we look around at some of his other letters, and also in the book of Acts, we can learn a little bit about some of these other positions. So, for example, prophets. They did have prophets in the early church. A prophet's role, from what we can tell from the book of Acts, was to foretell problems that might arise in the church. I don't really have time, but I should read you this portion of Acts. It'll give you an idea that that's kind of what's going on here, because I thought it was kind of interesting. Acts 11, 27 and 28. "In those days, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. Then one of them named Agabus stood up and predicted by the Spirit that there would be a severe famine throughout the Roman world." This took place during the time of Claudius. So he's actually saying that a prophet came down, said there was going to be a famine, and then it came true in the time of Claudius. Okay? And we see evidence of both men and women being prophets. The teacher, if it has anything to do with what it was like in the Jewish synagogue, would have been someone who was to interpret the Bible. But in this case, it would be from a Christian point of view. All right, and when I say the Bible, I mean the Bible that they inherited. That means the Jewish Bible, because there is no other Bible yet. There's no New Testament yet. Okay, so they would be looking at the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish Bible, and looking at all the things in there that, you know, might have something to do with Jesus. And they found all kinds of stuff. There are a couple other offices mentioned. Now, this is in another letter that I didn't have you read, but it's a letter to the Ephesians. And notice what it said here about some offices. Ephesians 4:11. "And he personally gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some shepherds, and teachers. We already mentioned the prophets and the teachers, but now we have added on here evangelists and shepherds, also that seem to be some kind of positions of responsibility in the church. Who would an evangelist be? Well, it comes from the word gospel, good news. Their role apparently was to recount and explain and perhaps defend the events and teachings of Jesus, the events of Jesus' life and his teachings. Okay? So in other words, you don't have any written gospels yet, so you've got an evangelist who will get up and say, all right, I found some more stories on Jesus I heard. Guy was traveling through town or whatever, and he was supposedly there the day that Jesus did such and such. I got a great one for you. Okay, and then he'd tell you things, right? So he would be the one recounting the gospel to you at the meeting. The shepherd would be a person who does shepherding. And what does a shepherd do with a flock? You take care of the sheep, right? So the shepherd would be the one who tends to and feeds and guards the sheep. Metaphorically, the congregation, the church, is often called a flock of sheep. Okay? So the shepherd would be the one who takes care of them. All right? Now, what's interesting about all of these offices I just told you, if they're to be called offices, prophets, teachers, evangelists, shepherds, they all fizzle out and will disappear by the second century. Okay? Prophets, later Christians don't like prophecy as much. Some will still get into it, but it won't be as mainstream as it is now. Teachers will get absorbed into other roles, other offices, so other people will be doing the teaching. It won't be a separate thing. Evangelists won't be necessary anymore because the Gospels are going to be written down, so you don't need one anymore. You've got the evangelist with a capital E, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, so you don't need the evangelist anymore. And shepherds also will be absorbed into other offices. And those other offices that do survive are the ones you see below. And these are the ones I will refer to again and again and again because they are the ones that last. So, what are they? First, the presbyteroi, the elders. A presbyter or elder, well, the word presbyter, okay, presbyteros is in Greek, that means elder, and it means somebody who's old, okay? But you don't necessarily have to be an old man. It just refers to someone with experience. But I think I mentioned to you earlier, when we were talking about the Jewish synagogue, that they had elders, right? So this is a carryover from Judaism. Elders who were kind of mature, experienced men that oversaw things in the group, okay? So they will continue to have those in the church, and they will last a long time. The word presbyter will eventually morph in English into the word priest. A lot of people think that perhaps, oh, well, these original offices gradually evolved into these later offices, but that's not the case. These ones are around just as early as those ones. Okay? And in fact, from what we can tell, different churches had different setups. Okay? So you might go to one and they have a little bit different organization going on. You go to another one, they have a little bit different organization. So you're not going to find the same hierarchy everywhere you go. All right? But there are elders mentioned in the book of Acts. Okay? Some of them are appointed directly by Paul or other apostles. Other ones are elected by their own churches. There doesn't seem to have been one way of doing it. There are three elders in particular that seem to have been important in the early days, and those would be the elders of the church in Jerusalem, because they were three of the 12. Well, actually, no, two of the 12. One of them wasn't one of the 12. And that would be Peter, who was one of the 12, John, another one of the 12, and James, the brother of Jesus, okay, who apparently did not become a follower of his brother until after he died, because we don't have any evidence of him being around before then, okay, following him around, I mean. And of the three, James, the brother of Jesus, seemed to have held the most authority, but that could be because Peter and John weren't always around. They were off preaching, okay? We're going to talk about James quite a bit coming up. Another office that later on will be considered separate from elders, okay, would be the bishops. But in this first generation, it appears that an elder and a bishop is the same thing. Okay? That it's just two different names for the same job. The word bishop is a corruption, that's an English word, is a corruption of episkopos. Episkopoi is the plural. All right, it means overseer, someone who has oversight. For example, when Paul writes to the Philippians, he doesn't make any mention of elders. He simply mentions bishops and deacons. So it suggests that, well, why didn't he mention any elders? Well, maybe the bishops were the elders. But that isn't the only reason. There are other books as well, even from slightly later, that mention, use the words bishop and elder interchangeably. So that's why we think that they were not originally separate, but gradually became separate offices. Now, later on, what will happen is the bishop will be considered higher on the totem pole than the elder. But in this first generation, they seem to be the same. Okay? And finally, we have deacons, diakonoi. That comes from a word meaning servant. All right? A minister, somebody who waits on somebody else. Forms of this word are all over the New Testament. Now, sometimes they seem to be not referring to a special office, but just to a servant. You can't tell, right? It has the word, and you're like, now, is that just talking about some regular servant of somebody? Or is that like one of the people in the church who is like, oh, I'm a deacon? You don't really know. You have to kind of guess. The translator has to make a guess here. If he thinks it's just a regular servant, he'll translate it servant. If he thinks it's an office, he'll say deacon. All right? So you kind of have to go by the context. But whatever the case, there is definitely no doubt about it that both men and women in this generation served as deacons. Peter's mother-in-law is said to be a deacon, and it looks like it's an office. There's another woman named Martha who apparently was a deacon. Paul introduces Phoebe as a deaconess. He uses the feminine form of the word. So, what do? They're just helpers, assistants, people who help the elders to get things done. They're usually like involved in the food distribution and things like that, taking care of people. So kind of like the workhorses of the church. One thing I want to mention about these positions is that in any early religious movement, charisma is extremely important in order to keep it going. And charisma, the way we use the word today, is a little different than I'm using it for back then. Charisma isn't somebody who just has like a really cool personality and everyone likes them. It's not just that. That's involved in it. But people actually believe that if you have charisma, that that's something divine. You've got the Spirit of God in you. And that's making, you know, you very likable and people follow you. You've got charisma. Jesus had it. The apostles had it. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them did. And that gets people on board, right? People love these people. They flock around them. They've got the Spirit. And there were, in the early days, more charismatic dimensions to the church. Like prophets, for example. How do they know the future? Because the Spirit tells them. It's a very charismatic sort of position. What is going to happen over the next century or two is that all the charismatic elements are going to be eliminated from Christianity. Okay? Because what happens, you can't survive that way. It's too chaotic. You never know what's going on. We'll talk more about this later, but there's not order. And as you get bigger and there's more people to control, right, you have to do things more by the book. You have to make it a little bit less willy-nilly. Okay? So you start having more organization, and you start eliminating these very charismatic elements of Christianity. But, you know, if you're trying to hold a meeting and suddenly someone stands up and he's like, I got a message from God, you know, the guy up front is probably like, oh, great, you know. But people in those days, and we're talking about not just among followers of Jesus, but among a lot of the religions and even in polytheism, that kind of stuff was really, you know, they thought it was really great. Evidence that, you know, the gods are with you and so on and so forth. So there was more of that. All right, Judaism and the Gentiles. I told you before that a Gentile is a non-Jew, right? Very soon after Jesus died, there was a significant community formed in Jerusalem. Okay, and from what we can tell, the leading figures there were James, the brother of Jesus, and also Peter, and perhaps also John. Okay, but the book of Acts and Paul's letters suggest that James had more authority there than Peter. Okay, and again, maybe that's because Peter wasn't there all the time. But the New Testament makes it very abundantly clear that the earliest followers of Jesus were all Jewish. Okay, that means that they continued to observe the Jewish holidays. They would go to the temple. I showed you a verse where they still went to the temple. That means they performed sacrifices there. They observed the Sabbath. They circumcised their children. They followed the Jewish dietary regulations. They followed the Torah. Okay? The only difference is they believe Jesus is the Messiah. Okay? And that's how they differ from the other Jews. We have evidence that even 60 years after Jesus died, members of the Jesus movement are still worshiping with other Jews in some places. Okay? Going to the synagogues or whatever. So what this movement is really Judaism plus Jesus. Okay? That's what we should look at it as. In other words, they are thinking of themselves still as Jews, but we're the correct Jews. Okay? We're the right Jews as compared to the wrong Jews. All right? And the split between Judaism and Christianity doesn't occur until the end of the first century. All right. Now, I read to you about a squabble that took place between the uneducated, rural, Aramaic-speaking Jewish followers of Jesus, who would represent the majority at the time, and the urban, Greek-speaking, Hellenistic Jewish followers of Jesus, who were starting to get interested. All right. And it was about the inequality of the food distribution. Okay. But what does that tell us? It tells us that in the early days, probably the ministry was focused on the rural Aramaic-speaking Jews, and they were getting most of the attention. Okay? And also, it also tells us about territories here, countryside rather than city. Okay? They're working in the country before they're working in the city. They're starting to work in the city, but that's not where they go first. But the movement seems to have taken slightly different forms based on your cultural location. If you went to a house church out in the country, and then you went and visited another one in the city, you'd probably see a number of differences between the two groups. The Gospel of Matthew, all right? That appears to point to a very Jewish, rural, or semi-rural village culture. It's being addressed to those types of people. All right. Matthew locates Jesus' post-resurrection appearances exclusively in the Galilee, okay, which is mainly country territory, all right, and that's where Matthew has most of Jesus' ministry occur. In contrast, Luke and Acts focus on the urban centers and have all of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances in and around Jerusalem. Okay, that may say something about to what audience they're addressed. All right. Now, the unfortunate thing is that early on, we don't have any writings preserved from either rural Galilean churches or the Jerusalem ones. Okay, but we do have Paul's letters help us a little bit. Here's the thing about Paul. He caters to the urban Hellenistic Jewish followers of Jesus, and even, well, actually non-Jewish as well. He's very interested in the Gentiles, but he doesn't even mention churches in the countryside. Not even of concern to him. He knows about the congregation in Jerusalem, or congregations in Jerusalem. But he's a Hellenistic Jew. Paul, and I'll tell you about him in a minute, he was from Asia Minor, from an urban territory. He spoke Greek as his primary language. He was not really into the whole country thing. Okay, and so we have to keep that in mind when we read his letters. His main city that he was interested in, the one where he apparently was converted, was Antioch, which is in Syria, far north of these areas I just showed you. Okay. Anyway, the point I want to say is that early on, most of the followers were Jewish, but we're now starting to get into a time when they're starting to convert Gentiles. Okay. Now, how is that going to change the church? It's going to change it big time. All right. Because the question comes up. Let's say I meet some Greek guy, right? Hey, yeah, this Jesus, he sounds really cool. I want to join up, you know? What do I have to do? Well, there was a difference of opinion here. What about the Jewish Torah? Does a Gentile convert have to follow it? You know, we're all doing it. We celebrate the Jewish holidays, you know, we follow the dietary regulations, we circumcise our children, all that. Now, what does this new guy have to do? Well, there was a difference of opinion. Some members of the church wanted them to, yes, of course, you have to become Jewish first. Naturally, you have to follow the Torah. All right? Very big on that. We call those Judaizers. That's what Paul calls them, Judaizers. Okay? You're trying to make these converts to Jesus as Jewish as possible. All right? So they have to do all that. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the Hellenizers. Okay? And those would be the ones who say, no, no, they don't have to do all that. If they want to follow Jesus, they can follow Jesus. We'll get them baptized and so on and so forth. But they don't have to follow the Torah. All right? Besides, how are we going to make any converts? You're going to go up to, you know, some adult male and you're going to say, well, you know, you're going to have to cut off your you-know-what. What? You know, and you can't have pork anymore. You know, and you can't do this and you can't do that or the other thing. Never mind, I'm not interested anymore. You know, that's what they were worried about, the Hellenizers. So they'd say, let's not throw all these rules on them. We'll never get anybody then. And we want this message to spread to non-Jews here. All right. And then there were a whole bunch of people in the church that were in the spectrum in between who were like, well, maybe we should be somewhere in the middle or what, you know. So there, this is the first major controversy among the members of the church. What to do about the Gentiles? What are the requirements for membership? Okay? Now, the strongest advocate for observing the Torah, Mr. Number One Judaizer himself, would be James, the brother of Jesus and the head of the Jerusalem church. The biggest advocate for abandoning the Torah when it came to Gentile converts was Paul. Big-time Hellenizer. But, okay, well, anyway, we're out of time, so we'll talk more about him next time. Make sure you keep up on your reading.